Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. All right, adults, if y'all have your Bibles, let's go ahead and find Revelation chapter 18 this morning. Revelation chapter 18. I'm going to trade out podiums here. Revelation chapter 18. We have been walking faithfully through the book of Revelation for quite some time now. And as I like to say, we are getting close to the short rows here. So here's how we're going to tackle this passage this morning. We're going to read it in chunks, and so we'll read a few verses and talk about them, and read a few more verses and talk about them, and that's kind of how we'll go for this morning. Make sure I'm on. There we go. All right, so let me get you caught up, because I know some of y'all are here, Tanner's Baptism, and so you haven't been with us for a while. And so let me get you caught up on Revelation. So we have, I gave everybody three lines of code that we've kind of been working through, but I want to add a fourth line that I should have added a while back. And so our three lines of code about the book of Revelation in general is this. Number one, Revelation is written to real people in a real place with real problems. And those people are not you and me, right? John wrote this letter to real people in Asia Minor around 90 AD, and they were going through real problems, and they lived in real cities in modern-day Turkey, ancient Asia Minor. All right, so that's code number one. Real people, real places, real problem. Code number two is, or line number two of the code is that there is a background that we, and context that we have to keep in mind, and you can remember it this way. Roman imperialism, emperor worship, and false doctrine. And those are the problems or the background for the context of the situation. Roman imperialism, Roman domination, emperor worship being pushed on the masses, which led to false doctrine creeping into the church. So that's the code number. Real people, real places, real problems. Roman imperialism, emperor worship, false doctrine. Now here's code number three. Revelation is apocalyptic literature and is filled with symbolism and imagery. What that means is if you go into reading Revelation like you read the Gospels, you will be sorely disappointed and confused. What that means is you have to remember that Revelation is written in code, in imagery, in metaphor, in story. Okay? It's like reading a poem versus reading a narrative story like you did in high school, right? You had that section where you did American literature, and it was all those The Scarlet Letter and all of those books. And then you, at some point, you switched over to reading poetry, which in my opinion was even worse, right? Thank you. But Revelation is written more like poetry than it is like narrative story. All right, so you got to keep that. And here's code number one, or code number four, or line number four. And this might be the most important one of them all right? And this occurs in Revelation chapter 1, verse number 1, which says, the revelation of Jesus Christ. And what we get there is the key to the entire book. Here's the key. Revelation's author is Jesus, and he is the star of the show. Right? So if ever you get to Revelation, you're like, I don't know about this. Remember, Jesus is the author. He's the star of the show. Okay? All right. So those are your four lines of code that you need to know as we get into the book. Now, the section we're in today is within a broader section, or the chapter we're in today is in a broader section that started all the way back in chapter 6. Chapter 6 of Revelation through chapter 19 are one big section that deals with judgment. And what happens in those 14 chapters is that John presents cycles of judgment. So there's the seals cycle, there's the trumpets cycle, and we're in what's called the cycle of the dragon. And so we've talked about chapter 12, the dragon, which is Satan, and the beasts in chapter 13. You might have heard them called the Antichrist and the false prophet. We used a little bit different word for that one. Propagandists is probably a better word. But that's who we've looked at. And then chapter 14 continues that judgment cycle. 15 and 16 have the last of the seven judgments called the bowls. And 17 kind of finishes that story. And what we'll be looking at today is a continuation of judgment against those who don't follow after the Lord. Right? And so it's kind of, John is telling the story about how the dragon, Satan, and his beasts and his people, and what we, the phrase we used for a couple weeks is earth dwellers who serve and worship the beast, how they have been brought to judgment by the Lord. And John does this through this phrase, fallen is Babylon, or Babylon has fallen, right? And Babylon, and I'm throwing a lot at you right here because we're all trying to get on the same page, all right? Babylon is code word for Rome. So what John is doing, here's kind of the point to get to, and then we'll jump right into the verses. John is giving his ancient readers hope over the enemy of God in their time, which was the Roman Empire, and showing them how God can even defeat the greatest empire they had ever known, who was actively dominating them, persecuting them, and killing them even, right? And so chapter 18 fits into that portion of Revelation. So we'll read the first three verses, we'll talk about it, then we'll read a few more and talk about them. Here we go. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, which again is a sign that this is a message from God, having great authority, and the earth was made bright with his glory. Verse 2. And he called out with a mighty voice, here it is, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place for demons and a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable beast. Verse 3. For all the nations have drunk the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality. And remember, that doesn't mean the literal act. It is a metaphor for worshiping idols and worshiping the emperor and worshiping a false gospel. And the kings of the earth have committed immorality with her. That means they've been part and parcel with this false gospel. And the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxurious living. All right, let's talk about that. All right, so let's go back to verse number 2, I think it was. Verse number 2. Notice the phrase here, verse number 2. Notice the phrasing of the verb in the first part of the quote. What does it say? Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Now, let me ask you a question. You don't have to answer, just think about it. What tense is fallen in? Present, past, or future? Is past tense, right? John doesn't say Babylon is falling. That would be present tense. John doesn't say Babylon will fall, that'd be future tense. What does he say? Fallen. Now, let's be real. In this moment, had Babylon equals Rome, so had Rome fallen? No. That's the whole point of which he's writing Revelation, is because the Roman government is actively persecuting believers in their area and making them or forcing them into their worship and their worldview. So what does this tell us? Because it's not literally happening in their day, and it hasn't happened before their day, and it would be a while before it does happen. So why does this angel from heaven use the past tense to describe something that hadn't even happened yet? He does that because from God's point of view, it's as if it had already happened. In other words, what John is phrasing here, and John is communicating to his readers, is that it wasn't a matter of if it was going to happen, just a matter of when it was going to happen. In other words, from God's perspective, the enemies of his people were already defeated. Now that gives you, that to me, that gives hope, right? Because in the midst of it, it may like look like they have no hope, have no recourse or rebuff against the enemy. But what does John say here? Hey, look at, you're looking at it from your perspective, and you need to look at it from a higher plane of viewing. And from God's perspective, your enemies have already been defeated, right? Now look at how he describes. Now why have they been defeated? John uses two phrases. He uses dwelling place and haunt, right? Now when we think of haunt, what do we think of? Haunted house, right? Right. And we think of, ooh, ghosts and scary people, you jumping out of a dark, dimly lit room to scare you to death, right? Well, dwelling place, that's kind of easy for us to understand. It means residence. Haunt is interesting because it doesn't mean haunted house. It literally means custodian or guardian, which I thought was interesting because that's not how the image that we think of when we hear the word haunt, because we think of haunted house, especially this time of year, right? So what is John telling his readers and therefore telling us about why Rome has fallen or has fallen from God's perspective? Well, one, they've become a dwelling place for all sorts of evil. That means evil resides in the empire, in Rome, in the Caesars, in the structure. Evil resides in Rome. But more than that, he could have stopped there and put a period. But because he uses the word haunt, and haunt means custodian or guardian, what John's trying to reveal is that they just don't let the stuff, they are taking care of it. And they are trying to help it flourish. Think about it. Custodian. We've got some educators here today, or people who are working with Holly at the pre-K. And their custodian is Mr. Troy, right? He takes care of the building, right? Why? So that more education can occur. So that more kids can learn. So what do we get? It's not, here's my point. It's not just that Rome is allowing or okay with evil being done, all sorts of evil, but they are fostering it so that it will grow and become better so that new versions of evil might go out into the world. And so John is saying, this is why Rome has fallen. Now, when we get to verses 4 through 8, that's kind of the next section. Let's read those really quickly. Then I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her plagues. Verse 5. For her sins are heaped high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Verse 6. Pay her back as she herself has paid others, and repay her double for her deeds. Mix a double portion for her in the cup she mixed. Verse 7. As she glorified herself and lived in luxury, so give her a like measure of torment and mourning. Since in her heart she says, I sit as a queen, I am no widow, and mourning I shall never see. Verse 8. For this reason her plagues will come in a single day, death and mourning and famine, and she will be burned up with fire. For mighty is the Lord God who has judged her. All right, so there's two messages. Both of these messages are to believers, right? So John is speaking, the angel is speaking, John's recording the message to the original readers, to you and me today even. And here's what the message is. Number one, the first one is in the first verse, come out of her. In other words, come out of Rome. Not necessarily physically walk out of Rome, but what he's meaning is do not be any part of the evil empire that Rome has become. Have nothing to do with the worship that Rome is purporting and the worldview that they are pushing and operating under. Don't have any part to do with that. Now, if you'll remember, or if you remember reading way, 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 way back when we first started this and we were looking at the seven churches that this letter's written to, there were several churches who had people inside the church who Jesus, now remember, those are the red letters, right? If you've got a red letter Bible, chapter 2 and 3 is into red letters. So this is Jesus speaking directly to these seven churches. And Jesus says to a couple of those churches, paraphrasing here loosely, be careful, watch out, because you got people in your midst who are pushing idolatry. And syncretism was the word that we used. In other words, there were people inside these seven churches that received this letter who were saying, hey, hey, look, 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 look. You can worship Jesus and the emperor at the same time and in the same way. And what did Jesus do in that point? No, you can't. You can't do that. You can't offer a sacrifice to the emperor and then say you love Jesus at the same time. That's not how it works. And what are we seeing here today? That same message being taught, just in a different way, with different words. In other words, this angel is reminding the readers of this first letter, you might live in Rome, but you cannot be any part of the worldview and worship that's going on in there. In other words, there was a group who came out with a song way back yonder in the 90s. I don't even remember the name of the group. But the name of the song was Be in the World, but not of the world. And that's exactly what John is saying or recording, repeating from the angel to these original leaders. Come out of that. Don't have anything to do with this system. But then he gives another message, right? Here's the second message that he tells his, it's in your outline. Here's what he says. He says, not only are you to come out of her, but Rome's payback is equal to its activity. All right. Now, when I read this verse, I couldn't help. And Ren's going to pull up. We're going to go out of Revelation just for a second. And we're going to read two verses in Galatians chapter 6. All right. Galatians chapter 6. Here's what it says. When I read this verse, when I read this section in Revelation, this is the verse that I thought of, 7 and 8. Here we go. Do not be deceived. This is Paul writing to the Galatian church. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever one sows, that will he also reap. Verse 8. Listen. For the one who sows to his own flesh will from the flesh reap corruption. But the one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap eternal life. Let's go back to verse 7. Read it again. Here we go. Whatever one sows, that will he also reap. Now, the Bible doesn't have all of these in one section, but throughout the Bible you get several of what scholars and preachers and pastors call laws of the harvest. This is one of them. Whatever seeds you put in the ground, that's the seed you're going to get. The other part of that is, whatever you put in the ground, you're going to get more of that. Same thing, right? That's just how it works. If you plant a seed in the ground and it grows up and it's a corn or tomatoes, hopefully if you plant a tomato seed, it turns into a plant and you just don't get one itty-bitty tomato. Hopefully you get a ton of tomatoes. Or if you plant corn, each cob has dozens of seeds on it, right? And so what do we see when we take these two passages from Revelation and Galatians and put them together? Rome sowed the seeds of idolatry and wickedness for generation after generation and generation. And thinking that it would all turn out okay. And that they would reap a harvest of goodness, joy, mirth, happiness, power, control, all of that. But what do we see here? That's exactly the opposite of what is going to happen. The angel is telling his believers, you need to come out of her, one, because you don't need to be associated with that. But number two, those who are will not reap the reward they think they're going to reap because the seeds they planted are not of a godly nature. They are of an evil nature, and those seeds lead to destruction, right? And so John is telling his first century readers and us today that the evil empire of Rome will be paid back in an equivalent manner to the seeds that they sowed. which leads, as we've seen in previous weeks, leads to destruction. All right. Now we're not going to read all of these verses, but in verses 9 through 19, in the biggest chunk in this passage, John talks to three different groups. He talks to kings, merchants, and sailors, right? Which in some sense represent the sprawl of the empire, the economic activity and impact of the empire, and the business nature and vast wealth of the empire. Again, when you get home this afternoon, just read verses 11 through 13. John lists a list of items that could be found in Rome. Now listen, if you go back and you do historical research, what you'll find out, I didn't do this, but one commentary I read had it all laid out and listed everywhere in the empire or everywhere in the world that these items were found that could have made their way to Rome. And listen to how far the spread is. It's all the way from Spain to China. That's a long way. Think of silk. He mentioned silk. Silk, China, in the ancient world. So what does that mean? Somebody got to get it on a horse or in a buggy, go around the Himalayan mountains or the Hindu Kush in Pakistan and Afghanistan, then get it on a camel and take it across the desert, throw it on a boat, and then keep going, and then put it on another cart, get it all the way to Rome. Right? It's the span of the whole Eurasia from one end to the other. And then on the north and south plain, all the way from Britain to Egypt, and then all the way down from North Africa to Arabia. All of that flowing in to the city, right? To pump up the economy and the wealth and the prestige of one place that then doesn't take those goods and use them for good, but then turns it into evil, right? And so all of these three groups, they do two things. Number one, they are uniquely tied to Rome. For example, the kings are, in this passage, are not the king, but kings, plural, which means what John has in mind here are client kings or vassal kings that are only kings because Rome said they could be kings. Right? Think Pontius Pilate. He's the governor of Judea. Why? Because Rome said he could be the governor of Judea. If you read the birth narrative of Jesus, we'll be headed toward Christmas here soon. And you'll read about Herod. That's Herod the Great, right? Herod the Great was king of Israel or king of Judea. Why? Because Rome said he could be king. Period. That's the only reason. Or Rome allowed him to be, right? And so they're each uniquely tied to Rome, but then each of them wails and weeps because they see Rome fall. Well, why do they do that? Well, we just talked about the kings. Without Rome propping them up, what do they have? Nothing. Some of you live through this era. You know what this looks like because some of you live through the fall, or probably remember it better than I do, the fall of the Soviet Union. What happens, you know, when they tear down the Berlin Wall? And what happens when the Soviet economy is in the tank and the Soviet Union like ceases to exist? All of those Eastern Bloc countries that were communist by force, are they communist today? Most of them aren't. Probably almost all of them aren't. Why? Because the people who were propping them up militarily, economically, and all that, when that's gone, they don't have nothing. So why are the kings weeping? Uh-oh, I'm in trouble. Because my foe, they don't really like me. And the only reason I'm in power is because I got the legions backing me up. And if I don't have the legions backing me up, right? The merchants, why are they weeping and wailing? Because their entire livelihood is built on bringing goods from one end of the empire to the other and selling them progressively for more and more and more and more. I mean, listen, I talked to a guy who farmed watermelons in Georgia. And he said one year he got a load of watermelons. You know around after July 4th how much you can get a watermelon for in Cordell? $1. You can get a cantaloupe for 50 cents. He said one year they picked a truckload of watermelons, and he started going north. And he said he got up, you know, outside of Atlanta, and somebody was like, "Hey, man, can I buy a watermelon? How much are they?" He was, $3. He sold them for $3. He said, long story short, he got all the way up to Chicago and still had watermelons. And folks were paying $11 to $12. Now that was like 10 years ago for a watermelon. Right? So he progressively started selling them more and more and more and more until he come back with an empty truck alone. That's what they do in this day as well. They sell it for more and more. And so these people are making money hand over fist. And now guess what? Their whole business model is gone. The sailors, what do? They're weeping and wailing as well because their whole business is gone. Because if there's not an empire, you don't have any goods to sell. Right? And so we see this fact played out in two ways, all right? One historically and one textually. So I want to make a textual connection, but I want to talk about a historical reality as well. This reality, this may sound wild, and I imagine the first century reader thought, boy, I don't know about all this, right? Like, how can this monstrosity cease to be what it is, right? But did you know that in AD 150, that's about 60 years after Revelation was written, give or take, plus or minus a few years, that the historians estimate that the population of Rome, just the city, not the empire, just the city itself, was 1 million to 1.2 million people. That's a lot of folks, right? Listen to me. By the time the Roman Empire collapses, the city of Rome's population had declined by 95%. How about this? The next time a European city would reach 1 million people in population was 1827. And it would be the city of London. Think about that. 1677 years. That's a long time. No European city ever reached 1 million people between the fall of Rome, between AD 150 in 1827. And by the time Rome falls, 95% of the population evaporated. That's crazy. How about this? Economic historians have estimated, and this isn't a huge number, but by ancient standards, a pretty huge number, estimated that the GDP, that's the gross domestic product, of the Roman Empire when Jesus would be a teenager to a young adult, 14 AD, okay? Right? Was $50 billion. Okay. Now, in today's standard, that's not a lot. But by ancient standards, that's huge. Because you want to know why? After the empire falls, it is not until 1500 that the entire continental Europe reaches the same level of GDP. So from a historical perspective, what John is saying absolutely takes place. That's pretty wild, in my opinion, right? Now, here's the textual piece. See, all the way back in John, and even though you hadn't been with us, maybe you'll understand the language. And all the way back in John 13, John talks about this mark of the beast, right? We talked about it, 666. Ooh, right? That's what I hear in my head whenever I, you know. And it says, without the mark, you can't buy or sell. And some of us today are like, oh, the mark of the beast, oh. But what is John doing here today? I want to read you a quote from Gerald Stevens. Here's what he says. In this text, all three of these groups represent those who are at the forefront of having the mark of the beast. In other words, the mark is for the market. It is a market reality or a market thing. Thus, in this context, John seems to suggest that the mark is not a physical mark, but is an abstraction encoded in reality, showing the culpability of all those who participate in any level of Rome's godless, dehumanizing, and commercial enterprise. In other words, you're seeing, mark of the beast, what is it? It's this right here, buying and selling all across the empire, not to benefit people, but to dehumanize, delegitimize, ostracize, persecute, and beat people down over and over and over and over again. Thus, when we get to verse 20 through 24, we see there is a great call to rejoice on behalf of God's people. Why? Because as I said a couple weeks ago, to quote George W. Bush, the axis of evil has been destroyed. Right? Thus, the saints should rejoice. The apostles should rejoice. And all those who have followed after Jesus should and will rejoice at the demise of their enemies at God's hands. For the one who persecutes, maligns, and does evil against God's people will not stand forever. Thus, there is great rejoicing to be done on behalf of God's people. All right, now, that's kind of what chapter 18 means. But we got to ask two questions. One, what's John's point for the original reader? And what do you and me need to get out of it today? So let's answer those two questions as we close our time here today. All right, here's number one. What is John trying to get across to the original readers? And I think it's two things. Number one, they're both on your outline. Number one, heaven sees your plight. Right? In the midst of the situation, it is often easy to think there's no way God sees what's going on in my situation. And what is John telling the people who were in the midst of trouble and trial and tribulation? Remember, one of the churches has already had a church member who's been martyred, killed, Antipas. And what is John saying? He's not saying, I see your trouble. What is he seeing? God sees your trouble, right? God sees the plight of evil against you. But that's not good enough, right? Just to see something. What is John also saying? Not only does God see your plight, but God is actively working on or for your behalf, for your good and his glory, right? So what do we see? Evil is being done. God sees it. God takes care of it. Now, again, the time span in which all of this happens may not be in the time span we want it to happen, right? Today, or yesterday for some of us, right? We want it done yesterday, right? And sometimes God doesn't work on our time scale. But what we do see here in John for the original readers is that God sees your plight. God works on your behalf. So what about you and me today? Because here's the reality. We don't live under a tyrannical dictator government. We don't live under the Roman Empire or the Empire of the United States. We don't have a Caesar running the world and telling us that we can't come to church together and all of that. So our situation is a little bit different. So how does this story apply to us today? Well, some of the same principles still apply from the original readers to you and I, right? God sees your plight when you and I are being unduly treated for Christ. God sees that. And it is still a reality that God works on behalf of his people to take care of evil. Again, it may not be when we want it, but it will happen. But here's where I think we need to settle today, okay? Listen to me. We need to settle, and it's really more of not as how does this apply, but it's what is the challenge we need to walk away from. And I do think it is that passage in Galatians, or that passage in Revelation where God says, come out of her, right? Because see, the idea for us, or the cautionary tale for us, is to not get so entwined or embedded with an empire that is not going to exist into eternity, right? That's the reality. The reality is what we're sowing in this life will have drastic effect in the next life. And for those of us who claim to be Christ's followers, we should be sowing the seeds of Jesus, not the kingdom of our own making. Right? Hey, look, I said it last week. We about 3 weeks away. 3 weeks still of political ads and this and that. But here's the reality. Some of us are hanging a lot of weight on who wins an election. And in eternity, it ain't going to matter. That's reality. And a lot of us are going to sow a lot of bad seeds on Facebook in the next 3 weeks. Come on now. We're going to sow a lot of bad seeds that we don't need to sow. And then we're going to be mad on this end when we don't get the harvest we think we ought to get. It's not because the plant, it's not the plant's fault. It's your fault because we sowed the wrong seed. And so whether it's this 3 weeks or whether it's 10 weeks from now or 10 years from now, whatever seeds we're planting, we need to make sure those are of a eternal nature that are going to last for eternity, that are going to produce the harvest that we want on the back end. Because look, here's the reality. You know, at the shake hands line at the end of church, if I were to ask everybody who came through the line, when you get to heaven, do you want to reap things you're ashamed of? I already know the answer. You ain't even got to shake your head right now. The answer is no. Because nobody wants to harvest things they're ashamed of. Boy, I wish I wouldn't have done that. I wish I wouldn't have said that. The problem is not on the back end. The problem is on the front end, right? It's here. It's because we didn't sow seeds that are honoring to the Lord today. Because here's the reality of the harvest. It don't come tomorrow. It comes later. Months, weeks, years from now. And when you get to that point, what I want for you, now you got to want it for yourself, but what I want for you is when you get on this side of it, the Lord can look at you and say, well done, good and faithful servant. You have done all of this. Come enter into my rest. Because you've sowed a lifetime of God honoring stuff so that when you get to the end of days, when Jesus returns and calls all of his people home, you don't have to go, oh man, this is going to be tough. Right? But it starts today. It starts by sowing seed that honors the Lord today. So that's the challenge. Right? Look, we don't know when the harvest is. We don't know Jesus is going to turn. We don't know anything that happened. But I do know this. What you plant today is going to affect your life tomorrow. The habits, the things you do today will be the results you get tomorrow. So here's your challenge. Sow seed that honors the Lord.
Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.